Dress the History of Fashion is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dress, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Hello, Dress listeners, and hello, April.
Hello.
Hello, my dear friend. I have known you now for well over a decade, but I don't think we've ever had the conversation that we're about to have. Do you know how you got your name?
Okay, well, we have definitely not had this conversation, because if we had had this conversation, I promise you, you would remember, because it's a little bit of a scandalous story. Apparently, my father had an ex-girlfriend whose name was April in the past, and I was named that without my mom knowing this. And let's just say that when she found out, she was pissed. She was very angry. And you know what? Fast forward some decades, my parents aren't together anymore. Maybe that was a sign. Just saying.
I think it suits you. And hopefully she didn't hold that against you growing up, because...
No, definitely not.
Yeah, you very much are an April.
Ah, well, thank you. How did you get your name?
So I actually had to call my parents this morning. It was really cute. They put me on speakerphone. They're like, okay. So, you know, it's back in the 80s before you can find out the baby's gender, right? And apparently my mom was convinced that I was a boy. And so my name was going to be Luke, which, if they've ever told me this, I had no clue that my name was going to be Luke. But they were a bit desperate for a girl's name in case I was a girl. And so they started watching TV and movie credits, looking for names. And apparently that's where they saw, Cassidy. And then my dad chimes in and he's like, well, and also there's a town on a map. We were looking at a map and there's a Cassidy, Wyoming. So that's how I got my name.
That's great. I love that. I like the fact that, so now, I don't know if any of our listeners have read about, like, there's people out there who are like professional baby namers, and you pay them something like $10,000 and they come up with baby names, which has to be the greatest scam of all time. But whatever, I'm sure plenty of people out there are paying it. But I love the fact that they decided, we're like, we're going to watch TV and movie credits, because also you yourself as a film and TV costumer probably sometimes appear in said movie credits.
Yes, that is so true. So maybe my name will be inspiration for some desperate parents in the future. But it's really funny because my sister-in-law just had a baby and they did not want to know the gender, and they didn't name her for like a week because it was this task, right? You meet your child and some people want to know their child first before giving them that name. It's a really, really big deal, and something I, of course, had to deal with a couple years ago when, on the eve of my son's birth, I had the luxury of knowing. And it was actually for a boy. It would have been harder with a girl's name, but it was a no-brainer for Sean and I. Leo's named after Sean's dad, Leonard, who sadly passed. And this was our way of honoring his memory and keeping it alive in the life of his grandchild. So, you know, very special, right? And there's so much meaning that goes into a name. And this week's two-part episode is dedicated to that very topic.
We are so pleased to welcome Isabel Flower and Marcel Rosa Salas to the show this week. Isabel is a New York City-based writer and editor. She is the executive editor of Deem Journal and editorial director of Foundwork. And Marcel is a cultural anthropologist and documentarian who hails from Brooklyn, New York. She is the author of the forthcoming book, Total Market American: Race, Data, and Advertising, which is going to be published by Duke University Press.
Together, they are creators and caretakers of Documenting the Nameplate, an ongoing community-based project and living archive that serves to document and celebrate the myriad of meanings embedded in nameplate jewelry, a global multicultural phenomenon with thousands of years of history. The project is a direct extension of their incredibly moving and insightful book, The Nameplate: Jewelry, Culture, and Identity, and we are going to learn all about both their project and book today.
Isabel, Marcel, welcome to Dressed.
Marcel, Isabel, thank you so much for joining me on Dressed. I am so excited to talk to you today about your incredible book and project.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
So my co-host April and I always joke that it was love at first fashion plate because we met over a decade ago and we immediately bonded over our shared love for fashion plates and fashion history. And I feel like you both have a similar story.
We do. Yeah. I think over one of the first things we bonded over, I mean, many things like Jordans, critical theory, being nerds, but also nameplates is kind of part of, I think, the origin story of our friendship, sisterhood, if you can call it, and business partnership and intellectual engagement over the past decade.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so important and also rewarding, right? To find someone who you not only share a passion with, but you can actually work with as well. Because you both also have a podcast.
Yeah, it's really special just to have like not only that camaraderie and shared passion, but also that trust that someone will come through on their word and always kind of have your back. I feel like that's the essence of partnership. And I feel very lucky to have Marcel in that.
Definitely. I do not take it for granted at all.
Yeah. And what a partnership you both have. And it's produced this incredible project and book that we're here to talk about today. But before we talk about that, I wanted to take a suggestion from one of the authors featured in your book, Rawia Kamir, who suggested, and I loved this, that you ask people in an interview, start an interview by asking if they know how and why you got your name. So do you know how and why you got your names?
I asked my mom this last night, actually, because I had to be refreshed on the tale. And the first thing my mom texted me back was, it defies gender binaries. I was like, okay, mom, that's not the story. Like, what is the actual narrative? And I have a twin sister. So her name is Ali and my name is Marcel. And so they're names that are traditionally, I guess, like gendered male. So she kind of liked that. I guess in the 90s for her, that was kicking the patriarchy's ass at the time. But she also informed me that in her 20s, she had a close friend who adopted a child and named her Marcel after Proust. And then my mom was like, oh, I really like that name, and started to kind of doing her own research and reading about Proust. And then my mom always talks about how she kind of had an intuition of what my sister and my pop personalities were like. And I guess I'm like the spicy, less sweet twin. And so my mom thought that Marcel had a little bit of attitude and bite to it, which she says matches my personality. So there you go.
And what about you, Isabel?
Well, I'll start by saying that it's very on brand for Marcel's amazing mom to have been thinking about defying a gender binary 30 years ago. But my name is actually, the name Isabel comes from my mother's grandmother. So my maternal grandmother, her name was Isabel, but I actually never knew that because she went by Pearl. That was like her nickname. And I actually really love the name Pearl. And I had always thought that if I had a daughter that I would name her Pearl. But unfortunately, my partner did not like the name, so I was not able to do that. But I'm holding on to it for future naming. And my middle name, Atiyah, is my father's last name from his biological father. And he was later adopted. And his adopted name is Flower. So I have all those layers in my name.
Yeah. And names are really interesting, right? Because there's the meaning that our parents imparted into it, right? By giving us that name. And then there's the meaning that we embed and identify with that name. And of course, this is something that is at the heart of this incredible book. And Rawia was one of several people who contributed their book, which celebrates, and I love this quote from your book, the active cultural life of nameplate jewelry, and one that we will learn is multifaceted and has an incredibly long history. Can you first tell us about the inspiration behind this book and also why it's significant?
Well, as we mentioned just a moment ago, Marcel and I really like bonded over our mutual, I would say like infatuation, obsession with nameplates. And we had thought about even long before this project that it would be cool to do something with nameplates. We just didn't really have a something immediately ahead of us. So how this all started is that our dear friend Alice had a magazine out of Brooklyn called Top Rank, and that magazine was starting a podcast. Marcel was the podcast host, and she invited me to be her co-host. And we were trying to figure out what a good first episode would be for just a way to kick off with something that we really care about and would have like an excuse to research. And nameplate seemed like a very obvious choice. So we did produce that episode. It came out, I believe, in January of 2016. So we were working on it in 2015. And we, you know, kind of went pretty hard preparing. We got recorded anecdotes from friends about their nameplates. We visited jewelry stores all over New York City, but probably the most in downtown Brooklyn, close to where Marcel was raised. We emailed jewelry historians to like ask them what their context or opinion was about nameplate jewelry. It was very fun, but we learned from doing that research that there was just a lot more to this than would really fit in a podcast episode. And also, I think it's pretty obvious as well that nameplates lend themselves to a visual representation. I mean, you really want to see what you're talking about. And that's, you know, why we were so drawn to them. So fast forward years later, I think we finally landed through our research on wanting to turn this into a book so that we could not only share the type of research that we were doing, but have it be accompanied by visuals provided by the same people we were getting, you know, stories and testimonies from. And that is where it came from. But as you said, you know, it's an active, dynamic life of nameplates. So the book is just one little marker in, you know, nameplate history as it continues to evolve and be shaped every day.
I have nothing to add other than the fact that I guess personally, nameplates have just always been part of like the cultural ecosystem of like every community I've been part of. I grew up born and raised in Brooklyn, and yeah, nameplates are just these style fashion objects that every community seemed to embrace in some way. And so from a very early age, that was really compelling. It was almost like jeans, like everyone had a nameplate. I encountered my first nameplate in kindergarten. And it was the first day of school, and there was a student that joined our class. Her name was Estefania. I hope she hears. I've told the story so much. I'm like, I hope she encounters it one day. But she had just immigrated from the Dominican Republic to Brooklyn, and she came to Circle Time wearing a double-plated nameplate with her name that was framed by two pendants made of her baby teeth, which was a very like compelling contrast, like a gold chain with baby teeth. I'd never quite see the combination, and it was very alluring and compelling. And from that day forward, I petitioned my parents to get me gold jewelry. Obviously, they were not interested or willing to because, you know, very expensive, but finally was able to convince them to get me a nameplate by writing them a letter, which was, you know, the way to appeal to my mom is like have to make a kind of like a logical argument in a written form. And that letter is in the book because she archives everything, which I guess speaks to, I guess, my interest in documenting a variety of phenomena, whether it's in my work as an anthropologist or in my collaborations with Isabel. I'm like interested in gathering, amassing, and understanding how our personal history is reflected in the stuff that we love and use.
Yeah. And that was one of the pleasant surprises of the book, is because you have all of these wonderful contributions, and you save both of yours and your book designer's stories until the very end. And it was just such a treat to see not only this handwritten letter, which is so eloquently spoken and written. You have excellent penmanship for a 12-year-old. And then the picture of you next to it, which shows that you did succeed in convincing your mother to get you a nameplate.
Indeed, I did. Thanks, Mom.
Isabel, do you want to tell us a little bit about your nameplate origin story? Do you have an earliest memory?
Sure. Well, So per what I wrote in the book, I never actually had a like real nameplate. I say that with scare quotes until I was a young adult, meaning like a gold one. But I became aware of nameplates, I think, more through pop culture, but also, as Marcel just said, the fact that like everybody had one. So it was more something that I wanted to have because of my peers and my community. So I moved around a bunch when I was growing up, and I think that because of that, I was reflecting on this recently, like self-styling was super important to me because I was always kind of like communicating being new at several points. So I really looked up to the style of girls in my schools and, you know, older girls and what they were wearing. And I think that nameplates were such an important kind of symbol of self and also just of a fashion forwardness, glamour. You know, this is the 90s. Hip hop is super influential on pop culture and style. So that was why I think wanted one, even though I've shared before, like my father had a nameplate from babyhood on. I don't think that's actually where I got the desire to have one from. It was much more informed by my peers and my social context. And then I got my first one from a mall kiosk at Park City Shopping Center in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It was a same day pickup nameplate. Actually, I think it was one of the like ready within an hour ones, but it was made out of nickel or some kind of base metal. It was a single plate and it turned my neck green like immediately after wearing it, basically. So it wasn't really like a precious object that I would wear every day necessarily, but it definitely planted the seed in my head that I was going to get a real one at some point, which I finally did in my early 20s.
And something you both have spoken about with sharing those stories is that nameplates are a huge part of not only your visual culture growing up, but also the wider visual culture. It's part and parcel of hip hop fashion, for instance. And then your book teaches us about the history and like the wider cultural influences, which is something we'll also talk about in a minute. But I want to go back a little bit and kind of talk about why you wrote this book and the importance of the book, because despite the pervasiveness of nameplate jewelry, this is not something that was really deemed worthy of academic study or serious, you know, quote unquote, serious scholarly attention. And you both actually wrote the first academic article about nameplates. So can you talk a little bit about why you think nameplate jewelry hasn't been traditionally valued, and both within the jewelry collector sphere, because you mentioned you spoke to jewelry historians, but also academia as a subject? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, this is a really important question and kind of one of the driving forces behind our desire to do this research in the first place, not to necessarily, I think, hold academia up on this pedestal and say that nameplates need to be validated by it in order to be worthy of love, adoration as objects, but I think more to question a lot of the underlying race, gender, and class politics that frame how nameplates are perceived, characterized, deemed worthy of study, or even the way that they're kind of aesthetically classified as tasteful or tacky or both. And those types of, I guess, aesthetic judgments have shaped how people have reacted to our nameplates. I remember one time a professor that I had in grad school said, "Oh, it's really cool that you can wear like tacky things." You know, this idea that like I was wearing, I was, wow, like, thanks. I think she thought it was a kind of a compliment, right? Like, oh, you can really pull that off. But I think the question of why are nameplates within a particular design tradition, and I would say it was a double plated nameplate with an XO chain, so very much in like the hip hop New York East Coast kind of like design tradition of nameplate jewelry, very like truck jewelry from the 1980s style. But yeah, really audacious kind of a style that I think is historically attributed to Black and Brown communities, lower income communities, and as such is characterized often as ostentatious, in bad taste, tacky, too loud, right? And we see the fashion choices of people of color, in particular of lower income backgrounds, sort of treated with this kind of contempt and even criminalized, whether we think about like the hoodie or baggy pants, for example. We kind of have observed nameplates and NLRP of a specific design tradition be classified in a particular way. And I think part of what has motivated our research and scholarship around nameplates is to kind of unpack these broader systems of oppression that shape how fashion choices are perceived and classified, whether that's on people's bodies or as objects of study. So it was from that one comment that professor made that I could wear tacky things, to also some of the reflections that we received from jewelry historians of, you know, fine jewelry, and I use that in scare quotes as well, who basically conveyed to us that, you know, nameplates aren't fine jewelry, even though they're made usually out of, you know, precious metals, diamonds, things of that nature. So the fact that they wouldn't be considered fine jewelry, I think, was a contradiction that Isabel and I have been interested in exploring and combusting, really. But Isabel, I'll let you add to that.
I mean, you said it, but I think even though fine jewelry is supposed to indicate the use of precious metals and semi and precious gems, it really also conveys like traditions, designers, occasions, wearers. And I feel like because nameplate jewelry has a pop cultural association with hip hop because of how it was popularized, especially whether or not one is aware of its more extensive origins, that association heavily influences how it is historicized and how it is studied, which is basically exactly what Marcel just said. And that was like a huge fuel to us to receive this dismissive feedback about there not really being something worth studying there that made us just want to do it more.
Yeah, and our listeners are well familiar with this idea because we talk about it a lot on the show, that there are absolutely hierarchies embedded in or imposed on the clothes we wear and have worn historically, but also the histories we read, right? Who shapes the stories that are deemed history, right? History is just made up of stories, and it's who tells those stories and how they tell those stories that really affect the narrative, right? And you're really in many ways directly challenging not only how history's been written, how jewelry is valued, but also you're pushing back against traditional rankings of cultural property and personal adornment and what constitutes, and this is something I really love, a valuable archive. And I love this quote from an interview you did. You said, quote, "Our job is not to be historians or curators in a formal sense. We are archivists." Can you tell us a bit about your archive for this book and your method of researching it?
I think, like you said, it was really important for us not to identify as historians in this work, because not only are we not the authors of this history, you know, I like to think that this is a collectively authored open source. Of course, it is a book, but like a project more largely. And I think that ultimately there's also no way that any one person could know the full, like, scare quotes, history of nameplates, because nameplates are all about direct lived experience. Everyone has their own subjectivity. We're all on like a different plane with what they mean and where they come from. And the purpose of the book is to just shine a light and give a taste of the multifacetedness of that, the plurality of that. And there's this amazing historian and archivist, Maria Cotera, who we quote in the introduction. And I think that she describes in her work the archive as like a praxis of collaboration, and that it's in that space of the exchange of memories, like literally just having a conversation and sharing, where the past meets the present, and like that's where the knowledge comes from. So in that sense, nameplates history is also evolving. It's dynamic. Our archive is not a static repository of information that's like closed and done. You know, it's as nameplates are worn and continue to be worn and loved and made, that history changes. So on that note, our methodology, informed by that concept, was really focused on just accumulating as many perspectives and stories and images of nameplates as we could, because the more people who we spoke to, the more we realized that we actually didn't know as much about nameplates as we thought we did, which I feel even more so now at the end of the project, or at the end of the book, at least. Over the years, we've had a number of events and parties. This was pre-COVID, where we would hire a photographer whose work we really admired and invite people to come with their nameplate jewelry and be photographed and hang out and talk to us about their stories. We hosted these in New York City, in Los Angeles. We were going to in Houston, but we're actually unable to because of an extreme weather condition. But we have a dear photographer friend who kind of did that work for us and shared with us what he was able to collect. And we also had an email address, an online Google form. We started our Instagram for the purpose of collecting stories via DM. So the goal was really just to have as far reaching of a possibility of voices and to make the option to contribute to what we were doing as accessible as possible. And I think, you know, when you say the word archive, people sometimes think that you're talking about like some kind of phenomenon that's no longer active or like no longer happening. So sometimes I feel like I wish there was another word we could invent for an active archive, not necessarily in the past, but it's really exciting for us, like on that note, when this work is continued and built upon by others. That's super important to the project. Like, we're not the definitive authors. Even recently, we heard from the Lower East Side Girls Club and the Black Student Union at Baruch College that both communities are doing their own nameplate archiving open call using some of the prompts from the book and like collecting nameplate stories in their communities. So that just makes us really happy because it keeps it out of that like static space. But Marcel, did I forget anything?
No, I just elaborate that speaking to the Instagram, which we were weirdly resistant to. We were like, oh, another thing to manage. Ugh. We like bristled at it at first, but it was such an important data collection, if I can call that a tool and source of inspiration for us. I think we're inspired by several Instagram accounts that are collecting and sharing cultural histories through a submission-based format. I think of Veteranas y Rucas, Nueva Yorkinos. These accounts are submission-based history-making platforms, essentially, that people can submit stories and narratives, and together, taken together, the platforms are kind of telling this active cultural history of specific communities, whether that's Latinx people in LA, people of Puerto Rican descent in New York City, and really empowering people on a smaller scale and individual everyday level to acknowledge their capacity to be knowledge producers, historians. I think for us that the word democratizing is so annoying, but I guess the opening up of history making and knowledge production to exist not just within like academia, which is both of our backgrounds, of course, but really kind of blowing up that idea and saying that we could use social media as a way to tell stories and tell history in a new way, and in a way that doesn't see knowledge as this, you know, closed off, bounded thing, but is a more dynamic and ever evolving approach that empowers anyone with a phone and a Wi-Fi connection to contribute to history as it continues to evolve and change.
Yeah. And I mean, talk about an active living archive. I've certainly thought about it, but maybe not enough, that because there's so many, as you've kind of spoken to, problems with social media, but it is really valuable in that way, right? In the ways that you just spoke to. And in many ways, it is an archive.
Yeah, for better or worse, yeah.
Yes, for better or worse.
Those posts from high school and middle school, I'm just like, oh my God, why?
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/ today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/ today. April, Mother's Day is just around the corner. Do you know what you are doing for your mom this year?
I sure do. This year, I'm gifting her My Life in a Book, which is this very cool service that will allow her to turn her life stories into a beautiful printed book, complete with her own photos of significant moments in her life.
Yes, this is so amazing. And Dress listeners, here is how it works. So once a week, mylifeinabook.com will send your mom a question via email. And these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then your mom can either type her response or she can use their voice to text feature. And mylifeinabook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book.
So join us and check out mylifeinabook.com and use the code DRESSED at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use the code DRESSED for 10% off today.
So the result of your work is this beautifully illustrated book. It is such a moving collection about the meaning embedded in the jewelry we wear, and a subject that is close to both of your hearts, very much a personal journey, but also one that speaks to this wider community, these diverse culturally based practices. And something I wanted to kind of start with was just a little bit about the history and the historical precedent for nameplate jewelry that I was surprised to learn actually extends back thousands of years. Can you talk just a little bit about that history?
I think the best way to frame this is the idea that if you think about it, like wearing your name as adornment is something as old as human language. So if we're really going to zoom out on like what a nameplate means, that act has been going on for as long as people have been writing their names. They've been making things out of them. And an example of that that's in the book is these ancient Egyptian signet rings from the Met and pendants that are from like 1300 BC. There are gold signet rings that the purpose of them is to dip them in wax and like sign an official document. This is what pharaohs and other members of the Egyptian upper classes and royalty did. And then also, there's an actual in the Met hieroglyphic name pendant that is literally a nameplate necklace in the same sense that we have. So we were shocked and amazed by the breadth of some of these historical origins. There's also so many other examples, like I'll just mention a couple and then I'm sure Marcel will have a few others. But as early as the late medieval period, there's this tradition called posy jewelry in England, in which rings especially have these inscriptions on the inside that are for loved ones. They call them like secret messages. Sometimes they were names, they were poems, they're enameled in like a black lacquered paint. That also then became a point of intersection for Hawaiian heirloom jewelry when Queen Lilu Okalani received a gift from the English royalty during some quote diplomatic relations. And this like super rich tradition of Hawaiian heirloom jewelry came from that moment, which is still a huge part of that culture today. We received several submissions to that end. And that tradition is very unique because it has these bangles and more like a strip of gold with a name embossed with local flora and fauna engraved, also using enameling and old English lettering. There's also mitzvah jewelry of the Victorian era of the Judaic tradition, which is a type of mourning jewelry. So it tended to indicate the name of someone who had passed away or who was separated by a distance or something else of that nature. But that's just a few. I'll pass to Marcel. I mean, also just as a disclaimer, I'm sure there are many traditions that we didn't even find out about during this research. And I feel like we're pretty careful not to say that we have a bounded knowledge of what this entails.
I think that, one of the most exciting images that I was literally 2 weeks postpartum with my first baby, like calling the Titanic LLC, being like, can we get this photo? That was a wild goose chase. But one of the jewelry historians that we spoke to early in the early days, aside from giving us the fuel by dismissing our research completely, did provide us with this historical tidbit that apparently there was some nameplate style bracelet that was found at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean and was recovered during the 1980s. They were excavating the wreckage of the Titanic. So Isabel and I are like, wow, we have to find this image. We have to figure out what this is about. And there's actually like a host of Titanic message boards where people are really kind of obsessed with this bracelet and trying to figure out, analyzing ship records and trying to figure out which Amy it belonged to and what class background she was part of. And so, you know, there's a whole kind of historical investigation wormhole that you could go into there. But we did get the photo and we didn't get to license it, which was such a triumph for us. And if you see it in the book, it is a very, in our view, at least, a contemporary looking, I would almost say like hip hop aesthetic nameplate bracelet. I mean, it's made on a curb chain. It's diamond encrusted, something that I could definitely see anyone wearing right now, which I think for us challenged the types of theories or ideas that we came to the subject matter with. For example, I had this whole grand theory that the reason why script was so popular in nameplates is because of graffiti and the bow. And so that was completely dispelled by seeing this, I guess, 1912 nameplate bracelet. So that was, I guess, part of the historical story of this style that was pretty surprising, which I think was been, like any other research, the most fun part of it is coming. Well, maybe not fun for everyone, really fun for us, coming with certain assumptions and theories and having those interestingly disproven or challenged, and also kind of, I think, bringing into relief how style and trends as we know it kind of have this cyclical nature to them, where we're always kind of drawing upon the past in order to create trends of the present and the future. So I would say the Titanic bracelet was definitely a historical node that stays with us. And I mean, of course, we talk about in the book a lot about the role of nightlife and hip hop, sort of genesis of hip hop and that popularization of that art form as being instrumental to the mass popularization and consumption of nameplates as a style that has regional specificity. Then we could talk more about that, whether it's East Coast, Southwest, West Coast, and reflective of the communities that live in these places, and also how migration and movement in between these places bring styles from one part of the country and or the world to other places. So that is really also just to see that type of migration and cultural movement being reflected in nameplates and how they're worn and what they mean to people. That's a really big part of the history, but also the way that the style continues to change.
Yeah, and that was certainly something that I learned a lot about, was that, yes, there's this historical precedent, and also there's this multicultural significance found in cultures throughout the world and throughout history. One contributor to your book writes, quote, "Something I've always loved about the nameplate while growing up in the city is that despite having friends from different parts of that diaspora," and I think they're talking about the African diaspora, "it was something almost all of us shared. Nameplate bracelets are often the first pieces of jewelry given to children in West African cultures and thus remind me of my family every time I wear one." So something that this book exemplifies so beautifully is that nameplate jewelry is very much a global, multicultural phenomenon. And you talked about Judaic practices, but there's also the practice in Arab cultures. There are stories from people in Pakistan, Chicago, Mexico, Puerto Rico, Iran, West Africa. It's incredible.
Yeah, I think that's just a testament to the method. Again, I think making it open call was not only, I think, political for Isabel and I, in the sense of really wanting to crack open this idea that two people can be the sole authors of some subject matter. But I think practically speaking, we knew that we had our own personal subjective stories and histories of nameplate jewelry, but that's only our perspective. So making the product open call really made it possible for us to receive stories that about the popularity of nameplates with groups and regions of the world that we would have never known otherwise.
It's not even possible to summarize all the different ways in which this tradition is important to different groups of people. I feel like we really only scratched the surface in the book. But, you know, as Marcel mentioned, and I'll emphasize again, like, hip hop had such a huge influence on shaping the popular perception and also just the belovedness in pop culture of hip hop jewelry, African Americans, and also the African diaspora, as you mentioned, both through the Caribbean and from Africa. Huge influence and very much the aesthetic reference point. The innovators within that style legacy are like tremendously influential in what nameplates look like all over the world, like truly all over the world. I feel like every time we thought we had kind of put like a bound around maybe some of the key players, that we would hear even more, like, you know, also from Latin culture and the Caribbean, Panamanian Cara jewelry, different West Indian styles that you can find in New York, especially like in Brooklyn, Italian traditions of coming of age jewelry, particularly related to Catholicism and other and celebrations like First Communions and confirmations. Like you mentioned, the Middle East, Arabic nameplates. We also saw examples in Farsi and Urdu, bracelets from Africa. There's a beautiful example of two silver bangles from the Gambia. Also, one of my colleagues who, unfortunately, we'd already finished the book, so this couldn't go in, but sent me a picture of his mother's bracelet from Liberia, which was actually made from 24 karat gold. So she couldn't even wear it because it was so soft. I feel like this again speaks to what we said earlier about how wearing one's name is like an innate part of human culture in many ways. And that, I think, continues to be expressed by the variety of tradition and how this just like resonates in a very universal way.
Yeah, and this book presents an incredibly diverse range, as you've now spoken to, of stories across cultures, genders, continents. There are also consistent themes that pop up throughout the stories, and you've mentioned a few of them, and I kind of want to dig into them a little bit more. So you have themes of shared cultural identity, status, the commemoration of new life, but also lost lives. I love the story of the woman who like fought with her cousins to get her aunt's nameplate rings, and she was a mariachi singer in the 1940s. Like, there's just all these incredible stories that are embedded into this material culture. One very consistent theme that came up a lot is that nameplates are very much a rite of passage for people, both in childhood, where it is connected to coming of age, you know, when you're begging your parents for one, but also adults who bought it for themselves when they could afford it. And I think both of your personal stories speak to that. So can you talk about why you think nameplates are so significant in that way?
I think that part of it is the fact that coming back to the fine jewelry part, that they are like valuable objects made from precious metal. And I think jewelry throughout time has often had a significance as being a rite of passage to own and have, because it shows, I think, a level of responsibility and like self-possession that one owns this precious thing and wears it, keeps it safe, has that kind of responsibility. So I think that's part of it. And then commemorating, you know, different life moments, I also think, again, that nameplates fit into a bigger tradition of how jewelry serves that purpose of being like a memento, a token, a sacred object, a love object that is imbued with this kind of meaning, and that the materials themselves. I mean, I feel like there's a whole element of this project that we didn't really dig into in the book, but like is really interesting if you think about gold as a material throughout history, the imperial legacy of gold as an exploited and trafficked resource, you know, all of these things. Like, there's a whole other material aspect of this that is very relevant to thinking about jewelry's history and its like perceived value. But I think that also, you know, even though there's a variety of, again, we mentioned like births, heirlooms passed through death, different moments like weddings, graduations, communions, confirmations, bar and bat mitzvahs, other religious coming of age ceremonies, quinceañeras, like all of those. It was also interesting to me that throughout the book, yes, there were people who came to nameplates through heritage reasons, people who came to them through family, people who received them as gifts, people who got them through relationships, often through romance. But then there's also a like large constituency that I think that actually Marcel and I are probably part of this last category of just popular culture being the influence. So I think that there's no necessarily right or wrong way to come to one with pureness of heart, but it just speaks to the variety of ways that nameplates show up, I think, culturally in day-to-day life.
It is here where we are going to end part one of this two-part conversation with Isabel and Marcel. You're not going to want to miss part two of this conversation, which is coming your way on Thursday, when they both return to talk about the seismic role of the nameplate in hip-hop culture before discussing its kind of controversial crossover into American pop culture, thanks to one Carrie Bradshaw.
And in the meantime, be sure and check out our Instagram at @dressed_podcast, where you are going to find content connected to this week's episode with the hashtag #dressed349 and #dressed350. Specifically, this week, you are actually going to find a giveaway for this incredible book, Dress Listeners, The Nameplate, Jewelry, Culture, and Identity. So while on Instagram, be sure and follow Isabel and Marcel's Living Archive documenting their ongoing nameplate project, and that is at Documenting the Nameplate, and you're going to find a link to that in our show notes.
Our show notes is also where you will find a link to our Dressed bookshelf, where you can purchase your very own copy of their book. And the Dressed bookshelf is where you can also find in a whole huge array of our favorite fashion history titles and also books that have been featured on the show. And please remember, we do love hearing from you. So if you'd like to write to us, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com. DressedHistory.com is our website address where you can find lots of information about our upcoming fashion history tours, trips, classes, and anything else we have up our sleeves. So also too, Dress Listeners, you have about a month left to register for our next course, which is our very first section of the Great Designer Series. And if you happen to be in New York City, you can also head over to our website to find out more information about joining me for a private tour of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, because I'm running Fashion History Fridays.
On our website, you can also sign up for our newsletter and be the first to know about our upcoming Dressed Fashion History Tour of Paris. You have been extraordinarily patient, Dress Listeners, with us as we navigate planning this trip around the Olympics in Paris, which is no easy task.
No. This has become a little more challenging than we thought. Basically, listeners, what's happening is because Paris is, of course, like one of the most popular destinations in the world, right? So the Olympics happening there this summer is pushing out all of those people that would have been there in the summer, and it's pushing them out into the fall. So bear with us.
Yes. We hope to announce this in the next coming weeks. So stay tuned. And that does it for us today, Dress Listeners. May you consider what it would mean to wear your name next time you get dressed.
As always, thank you so much for your continued support. More Dressed coming your way on Thursday. Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.